Thank you, Prem. Thank you, Sai Prakash. And dear listeners, Sai Ram from Prashantinilam, the most happening place on the planet. As I always say, the Shivratri Akhanda Bhajan concluded just a couple of days ago, and what a bliss it was. What a moment of divine intimacy it was for so many. How many sacrificed their sleep, lost in the name of the Lord. How many suffused that night, only dwelling on the glory of His infinity, of His infinite love, on the melody of His glory. While some were singing, some were chanting. I saw so many devotees and students continuously chanting the Namakam and Chamakam, the Sri Rudram. That was their way of worshipping the Supreme Shiva. There were yet others who were doing Parayanams, reading holy texts, be it the Devi Mahatmyam or the Lalita Sahasranamam or the 1008 names of our beloved Swami. Everyone making that sincere effort to spend every moment of that auspicious night in connecting with the Divine. And after having spent such a soulful, soul-enriching 12 hours, when the morning dawned, it was the time for the grand finale of this night-long sadhana. And as expected, it ended on a high, a thrilling Shiva bhajan that simply spiritually electrified everyone.
Gangadhara, Hara Gangadhara, Hara Kailashanatha Prabhu Shankara. Gangadhara, Hara Gangadhara, Hara Kailashanatha Prabhu Shankara.
So that is how this celebration concluded. And how did it all begin? The Shivratri celebrations in Prashanti began with a beautiful and elaborate ritual of Saishwara Lingabhishekam. And last Thursday we discussed a bit about the significance of this Abhishekam. Why did Swami allow the devotees to do this Lingabhishekam on every Shivratri, and why did Swami himself do the Vibhuti Abhishekam on the Shiva idol? Why did Bhagwan bring out that lingam from his own being, taking so much pain? Why did he do this year after year? What is the message that we must learn from this divine act? This divine act of immense compassion. What is it that the Lord so painstakingly was trying to instill into our hearts? We dwelt on this a bit on last Thursday. Everything is laden with so much significance. That is what we discovered to some extent. But tonight I would like to go into these in little more detail, because all these traditions that are being followed, all these rituals that we have been observing, which have been passed on to us from our elders, from our ancestors, which are all associated with the Indian culture, they are not man-made. These are all what is mentioned in the Vedas. And Swami says Vedas are apaurusheyas. Apaurusheyas means they are not the creation of men. They have all come from that ultimate source. And that is the reason why if you read just one single translation of Vedic hymn, we should not think that that is what it means. If you have read a one line English translation of a mantram, that is a very, very incomplete meaning of what is conveyed in that hymn, because Sanskrit is such a mysterious and cryptic language. There are 9 grammars in Sanskrit, and when you look at a word through each grammar, it can give you 9 meanings. So if you take one word, potentially it has 81 meanings. And that is the reason why today, when you reflect on this, when Bhagwan used to give us inner significance of so many words, how he used to split the words and give the meanings, and it used to dawn on us how this word can convey something else. And sometimes you used to wonder, how could this be? But as you reflect on this, you know how limited your mind is. How divine is this language, Sanskrit. And how not intelligent, but how prayerful and reverent you need to be to get these answers, to get what is latent, the potent that is latent in these sacred hymns. Very few people can actually decode all these divine chants. And we are so grateful to all our elders who have ensured that these rituals continue, and they are carried on from generation to generation. And because they are carried on, there is opportunity for us to question, there is opportunity for us to reflect, there is opportunity for us to ponder, and then finally realize what is packed in these practices. For example, just take the daily ritual or practice of breaking the coconut. In one discourse, in a conversation with Dr. John Hislop, Bhagwan says, coconut breaking has so much inner significance. Swami says the coconut has 3 eyes, and that represents an individual. An individual has 2 eyes, but actually he has the 3rd eye, the eye of wisdom. So coconut represents the individual. And Swami says, as long as there is water inside the kernel, the kernel in the coconut will cling to the shell. And such a coconut will grow if it is planted on the ground. But if it is not planted, then the unplanted nut, when it ages, then the water disappears. And once the water disappears, the kernel leaves the shell. And then the coconut will not grow again. And Swami says, the water inside the coconut symbolizes desires. As long as there is water, as long as there is the series of desires, as long as we have this mind, which is this web of our wants, unending wants, then we cling on to the shell, this kernel, which is this individual, clings on to this shell, which is this world. Once the desires disappear, the individual finds the release. There is no birth, there is no death again. Swami went on and also explained how when you break the coconut and you offer the water to the Lord, that is surrender. You are breaking yourself, you are breaking your closed heart and offering the contents of that heart to you, the Lord. That is surrendering yourself, your limited self, at His lotus feet. If only we can reflect on this seemingly trivial ritual. It is because the ritual has continued that today we are able to reflect on this. Similarly, take the practice of crossing, people crossing their hands and holding their ear lobes and squatting in front of Ganesha a couple of times. You would have seen many people do that in front of Ganesha shrines. They would hold their ear lobes and they would squat up and down, as if asking forgiveness for mistakes committed knowingly or unknowingly. And many today might laugh at such a practice. But sometime back I read how modern science has today discovered that holding the ear lobes and stretching them is actually so beneficial for the brain. It actually activates those areas of brain which are responsible for improving our memory and our mental agility. So today, holding the ear lobes and stretching them is being marketed as a yoga. It is a brain yoga or a power yoga. And this is what the ancients told us. They divinized it. They told it, go to the Ganesha and do it. Every time you're in front of Ganesha, you do it. That is going to help you. That is going to help your intelligence. That is going to help your memory. Ganesha is going to bless you. Where is this Ganesha? Ganesha is inside. And when you do that, you're only activating that source, that power which is within you. But they gave it to us on a platter. They gave it to us in the form of such a simple spiritual practice. If only we were obedient. So all these practices that have been bequeathed to us from our elders and our ancestors, they have so much of significance. We will know what they mean only if we approach them in a sincere spirit of surrender. They say, men of intelligence have all the questions, but men of surrender receive all the answers. And one person who has approached these rituals in this attitude of surrender is, interestingly, an Anglican priest, Father Kumaran Francis O'Brien from South Africa. And the conversation that I had with him on this aspect of Indian rituals a couple of months ago is so insightful. And this is something that I really want to share with you tonight. So that is what I'll be praying for you. And after this, we will also have for you a conversation on the same theme with a Sai alumnus, Sai Giridhar Sairam. So these two are what is in store for you for this last segment of Thursday Live from the studios of Radio Sai tonight.
Tune into Sai. Spend the day with Sai.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. on Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
So welcome Welcome to Outside, Inside, Deep Inside, and today we are on this topic, unraveling the potent messages latent in Indian rituals. And as I just mentioned, first, conversation with Anglican priest, Father Kumaran Subrayan. Share it us.
Sairam and welcome Father Francis Kumaran once again to the studios of Radio Sai.
Sairam.
I have had the chance to look at some of the pictures of your church in South Africa where you practice as an Anglican priest, and it is so interesting to see how Lord Jesus Christ in your church is dressed in ochre robes and he is in the Nataraja pose, and you take out Mother Mary in procession and you do Aarti to Lord Jesus. So it's really so fascinating that somehow you have blend two religious traditions. So what is your take on these rituals, and what do you feel when you try to put together these rituals of the East and West, so to speak?
I think rituals are found in most religions. In fact, all religions will have some form of ritual. Whether it's in Christianity, the celebration of the Mass, which is seen as the most holy ritual of Christian worship, where bread and wine are consecrated and believed to be the very presence of Jesus manifest. Whether it's the pujas in the temple, or Muslims going on pilgrimage to the Kaaba. And so in every religion there's some form of ritual. And rituals are highly important because they are these outward things that we do that remind us of an inward reality that is always there. So in the Anglican tradition that I come from, and even in the Catholic Church, we have what we call the seven sacraments. Mm-hmm. And the traditional way of defining a sacrament is this. In the Catechism it says it is an outward visible sign of an inward spiritual grace. It's an outward visible sign of an inward spiritual grace. So we are doing something on the outside that signifies the grace of God that is existent on the inside. Some would even say that the ritual has the power to ignite that grace that's within us, to activate it in us. So obviously from my Hindu background and my Christian background, I've been brought up in two traditions that really see ritual as an important part of awakening to the higher reality.
The ritual is a journey to the spiritual inside.
Exactly. In fact, you see in the ritual, what we do is we entertain the five senses so that we may transcend the five senses and experience that which is beyond the senses, that which the eye cannot see, the mouth cannot express, that which the ears cannot hear and the hands cannot touch. So, you're going to, for example, an Anglican church or a Hindu temple for that matter. Immediately your eyes see a beautiful statue, a beautiful altar, murti. And so as you behold these things with the physical eyes, what ought to happen is you ought to pray and desire that your spiritual eye would be open and you see the Lord in his celestial glory. You hear bhajans being sung, the chanting of the sacred Vedas. You hear hymns being sung in the church. So we are entertaining the sense of hearing. And as we do that, we ought to desire to hear the voice of God, the sweet, still voice of God that's uttered in absolute silence. We smell the incense. We inhale that aroma. And what ought to happen is as that happens on the outside, inwardly we ought to desire to experience the fragrance of the Lord's presence. And then we touch something, you know. In Christianity, we often make the sign of the cross. You know, there's that whole aspect of touch. And as we do that, we ought to desire to feel the touch of the Lord. We touch the steps of the temple. We touch the flame at the Aarti. We place it to our eyes. In all of these things, as the outward sense of touch is being entertained in this ritual, we ought to desire that deep touch of the Lord that happens in the inner sanctum of the heart. And then in Christianity we'll receive communion, so there's the taste of the communion on our tongue. You know, our taste buds play a big part in daily life. And in the Hindu temple, we'll receive some prasadam, and we'll place it on our tongue, and we'll taste it. And as we taste that prasadam or the communion, we desire to eat of the presence of the Lord. You know, the Bible, Jesus says, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. So in a sense, we want to heat off the very presence of God. We want to digest that. We want to take it inside us. And as food determines how our body functions, so to eating of the spiritual food of God will enrich the soul and cause it to function at the optimum. And so these rituals that basically are designed to entertain the five senses, and I'm using the word entertain because they occupy the five senses with a celestial sort of, they give you a sense of the celestial. And so as five senses are aware of participating in something that's even beyond the ordinary, then your heart ought to open to the experience that's inward.
Wonderful. So can you now take specifically certain rituals and share with us your understanding and the significance that you have grasped of what they mean?
Okay. You see, in the Christian church, I mentioned the seven sacraments. Let me talk about the seven sacraments and then talk about the rituals in a Hindu temple and just compare the both. In the seven sacraments of the Anglican and Catholic Church, we basically consecrate and sanctify the different stages of life. And we acknowledge that God is present in these different stages of life. So we baptize a child at birth. Infant baptism is very important to us, because what we're doing there is we are consecrating that entry into the world. We're consecrating the life of this child in the world. So there's the sacrament of baptism, the naming ceremony in Hinduism. And then when the child comes to the age of adolescence, around there, we consecrate that part of life, because that's an important part of life. And we have a ritual of confirmation, where the child is encouraged to make a commitment to the faith and to Christ. And so there's confirmation. And then comes the point of marriage. You know, the child enters into adulthood and now he's about to be married. And so marriage is seen as a sacrament, holy matrimony, we call it. And so we sanctify that stage of life. Those who decide to enter into the religious life and become a priest, like myself, we'll have a sacrament called ordination, where we are set apart through this ritual to be priests to the service of God. And the bishop would use sacred oil called the chrism oil, and he would place the mark on our hands, the mark of the cross, to set apart our hands for the service of God. And even the daily process of life, where we constantly are struggling between the negative and the positive, our shortcomings and our strength, is dealt with in the sacrament of confession, where you can go to a priest and say, these are the areas I'm struggling with. And so even the weakness of human life is acknowledged as an important part of the journey and is consecrated and transformed within this ritual of confession and absolution. And even the moment of death, we have a ritual called unction, which is the anointing with sacred oil. And when a person is very sick, we would anoint them, asking for healing, but we would call it extreme unction when we anoint a person who is at the moment of death. And just as we consecrated the passage into this life, so we consecrate that moment of leaving this life. And so you see, ritual also sanctifies the entire process of human life, at least through the sacraments of the Anglican Church. In the Hindu temple, you find a very similar concept. The process of daily life, the rhythm of daily life, is consecrated through ritual in the Hindu temple. So, for example, God is woken up in the morning, there's the ringing of the bells and so forth.
Suprabhatam.
Exactly. So the waking up of God happens in the morning. And then often, in most temples, there'll be the ritual of Abhishekam, the bathing of God. Yes. So God is bathed. And then, after you bathe God, you give him some food, nevedyam. Yes. So food is offered, you know, which becomes prasadam. And then in the afternoon, God is allowed to rest. You know, we often close the temples, just like we take an afternoon rest sometimes. We allow God to rest in the afternoon. And as the evening hours approach, we wake him up again. We dress him up. and we get him ready to meet his devotees.
Yes.
And then at night time, God is put to bed. You know, we have a ritual where the deity is allowed to enter into a state of rest. Now, some people may look at that and say, oh, you know, that sounds very human for God to go through all these processes because God ought to be beyond this.
Yes,
God is beyond this. The one who neither slumbers nor sleeps, who's ever watching the universe, never sleeps. That is absolutely true. So we don't need to wake him up or put him to bed. The one who owns all the oceans of the world does not need us to bathe him, you see. The one who owns every fruit tree in this world does not need us to feed him, you see. But we are not doing these things because God is of need of it. We are doing it because it reminds us that God is present in that rhythm of our daily life. That when I wake up in the morning, that is a sacred moment. That God is present in my waking up. So when I hear the temple bells ringing early in the morning, you know, and the chanting starting to take place in the temple, if I'm close enough to a temple to hear that, it ought to be a reminder that I am awakening to God rather than God is waking up.
Yes.
You see, that is what the call is. So all the rituals that are done is not because God needs it. It's because you and I need it to remind us of the presence of God. So when we perform Abhishekam and we wash the image of God, during the Abhishekam one should stand there and not think so much that God is being washed as much as saying, what inside me needs to be cleansed so that I may experience God within me. You know, often when I sit and witness the washing of the Shiva Lingam in the Ramana Ashram or in the temple, I picture that pillar of fire, that Lingam of fire within me, and I imagine the Abhishekam is taking place within me. And then when the milk is being offered, for example, I will think, well, you know, God is constantly offering me the milk of his love. In so many ways, he offers us the milk of nourishment in daily life. Even the breath I'm taking every moment is nourishment being given to me. And so as that milk is poured upon the murti, I'm aware of God's constant motherly nourishment for me. Just as God first feeds me with the milk of mother at birth, and then throughout life feeds me with the milk of the cow, was also a symbol of the Divine Mother. I'm aware of this nourishing aspect of God. When purifying substances are used on the murti, like turmeric or manjal, again, I think of how God is constantly working on my purification. You know, even when I don't realize it, everything that's happening in my life, good and bad, God is very gently using all the circumstances to purify me of the ego, of past karmas, of vasanas, tendencies that seem to still exist. And as he's cleansing me of all of these things, he is slowly helping me to see the inner murti. You see, just as Abhishekan makes the murti more visible and shining so that we can behold it, so too an inward Abhishekan must take place, so that the murti within may be revealed. So, and obviously, depending on the festival or the temple, Abhishekams get more elaborate. But irrespective of what has been offered in the Abhishekam, we ought to allow an inward Abhishekam to take place to the murti within, the Atma within, and to let that cleansing take place within, that we may be the God, the darshan we will have after Abhishekam, the vision of God on the outside, may also happen on the inside.
Yeah, wonderful. In fact, that reminds me of the verse in Bhagavad Gita where Lord Krishna says what sort of fruit or flower that he expects from us. And Baba has always said, you know, what God looks for is the fruit of our noble actions.
Exactly.
What he looks for is not that water, but tears of love and devotion.
Yes.
I think when you look at all this patram, pushpam, phalam, as it is mentioned in Sanskrit scriptures,
yeah,
I think the rituals are in a way just to remind us what we have to do inward.
Exactly, exactly, exactly. So even, you know, new clothes are given to God each day. That it's a reminder that even the act of putting my clothes on can become a spiritual experience if it's done with that awareness of God. It's a reminder that this body is a garment that the Atma is using for now, and that I need to even transcend the body in the spiritual walk to see the Murti of God within, to see the image of God within it. So daily in the temple, the whole process of life is sanctified through these rituals. And one has to be careful that we don't get superstitious about these things, you know. We just assume that if we do these rituals, something will happen, God will protect us or whatever. If people do it, you know, God, if I do this ritual, then let my son get a job or something. And on one level, that's okay, because God is our father, mother. We can ask him for things like that. But as we advance in spirituality, we must internalize these things so that they help us to go inward to experience God within, to experience the Atma, the soul, which is the very image of God, the spark from the divine fire, which is the essence of who we are. At the end of Abhishekam, we often make most rituals, there'll be the five main offerings that will be made: Pushpam, Dupam, Deepam, Nevedyam, Karpuram. Pushpam, flowers, and as we offer the flowers, we are acknowledging that this one whom we are worshipping with all this ritual is the Lord of creation. Everything that is beautiful in this world, he has caused it. You see, the pushpam comes from the earth. It's acknowledgement that all of creation as its origin because of this one whom we are worshipping. So we offer him the pushpam. Sometimes when I stand in the temple, I internalize a prayer at that time and I say, you know, I may not have any flowers to offer you right now, but here's this heart, and by your grace, let the lotus of this heart open and bloom with absolute love for you. You see? And so, again, this internalizing of the ritual. We offer dupam, or agarbatti, or samrani. We offer in, incense to God. And again, we spoke about it the other day, the incense is rising, it speaks of higher consciousness. You see, you can experience the incense, but you can't contain it. You can't capture it when it's burning. You experience the smell, but you can't contain it somewhere. And that's God. We can experience God, but we must not limit him to our religions, to our doctrines, to the narrow-minded sort of boundaries we build around this experience of God. We must allow it to permeate and flow like incense beyond the boundaries of our religion, beyond the boundaries of our own doctrines and dogma. And then we offer deepam, the light. And that again is a reminder that God is light. And in him is this quality of light that has the ability to dispel the darkness of our ignorance. Valila Swami Ramalinga, so beautifully in that mantra, says, it's one of my favorite mantras, Harut Perum Jyoti, Tani Perum Karune, Harut Perum Jyoti. God is graceful light, God is supreme compassion. A couple years ago I visited Vadulur, where Swami Ramalinga's shrine is, and I ended it up there on the day of my birthday. And in that shrine, you know, the light is burning within, but these veils before would symbolize the sheets that prevent us from experiencing the light of the Atma are before the lamp, so you can't really see the lamp. And while sitting there, I had a very mystical experience of kind of moving beyond the sheets, but not the outward sheets, the inward sheets, and just for a glimpse beholding that light within. And that's what ritual ought to do at the deepest level, is help us transcend and move within. So we offer this deepam to acknowledge God is light. And all religions acknowledge God is light, you know. As I said, Arut Peram Jyoti, God is graceful light. Jesus says, I am the light of the world. And we find this reference to light in all of the scriptures. And then we offer Nevedyam to God. We offer food that's been prepared, which will become prasadam, food filled with grace later on. And again, as I said, we don't need to feed God. You know, God is self-sustained, self-satisfied within himself. Everything belongs to him. But we are acknowledging his providence. the daily food that I eat comes from him. So this ritual of offering Naivedyam to God is exactly the same as praying in the Lord's Prayer, Lord, give us this day our daily bread.
It's more an act of gratitude.
Exactly, exactly, exactly. It's an act of gratitude and it's an acknowledgement that God is the supreme provider of everything we have. And so we offer food to God. And then in the end, Karpuram is offered, a camphor.
Yes.
And the camphor is beautiful because, you know, when you burn that camphor, it gives a beautiful smell and a powerful light. But the camphor disappears.
Yes.
It emerges into the murti. It emerges into the atmosphere of the inner sanctum. And so it reminds us of the ultimate journey of the soul. The Atman needs to burn with this love for God, like the camphor. It needs to be on fire with this bhakti of God. And as it's on fire with this bhakti for God, then the ego and all of that selfishness needs to be reduced to nothing. And the Atma will finally return to where it comes from. It will dissolve into God as that Karpurpuram dissolves into the atmosphere of the inner sanctum. You know, we call the inner sanctum Garbha Griha, the womb house.
Yes.
The house of the womb. Or Mulasthanam in Tamil, you know, the root of all things. And so this inner sanctum where the Karpurpuram dissolves symbolizes the womb from which everything has come and to which everything will return. It symbolizes God himself, a self as mother, father of creation.
Wonderful. In fact, in one discourse, Baba gives this meaning of salam, which is generally used in Islam as a form of greeting, like you have namaste and you have
shanti.
Yes, in Indian culture. And Baba says that sa means Satchidananda, which is the ultimate one. And la is layam, to merge in that.
Right.
That is what is conveyed when we say salam, you know, merging in that Atma. And that is the meaning of namaskar or namaste or namo.
Exactly.
Because basically it is just, you're bringing all your 10 organs, 5 senses of perception and 5 senses of cognition, and you're just saying, I am nothing, everything is you.
Exactly.
It's so beautiful when you look at the meanings of all these traditions.
Yeah. In fact, in the Christian ritual of Holy Communion, the sacred mass, you know, the priest takes this bread and the wine. Bread and wine were the common things on the table of Jewish tables in the time of Jesus. So he only took what was available, you know. If he was in India, he might have used sambar and rice, you know. So he took what was available. He took the everyday common thing that they had in Palestine and he gave a divine meaning to it. In the Christian ritual of Holy Communion, the priest will take the bread and the wine and he will offer it to God. And then when it's given back to us from God, it's transformed into the body and the blood of Christ, meaning it contains the very presence of Christ. Very presence of Christ is there. But that ritual only is brought to completion when that bread that's been consecrated and that wine that's been consecrated is given to the people. So that bread and that wine, the presence of Christ, ends up within the people. So the body of Christ which was seen in the bread is now the body of Christ within me. Mm-hmm. I become the body of Christ in that ritual. So that ritual is awakening me to the fact that I am the body of Christ, that Christ is within me. My hands are the hands of Christ. Let him serve through my hands. My mouth are the mouth is the mouth of Christ. Let him speak through my mouth. Let him listen through my ears. And so in the ritual of Holy Communion, exactly that's what's happening, is this absorption into God. God is in me and I am in God. And often used to say to the church, after you have communion, don't bow to the altar, because we always bow to the altar when we enter the church. After communion, bow to one another. Because now the communion is within each other. See God in one another and ultimately bow to yourself. The inner Atma that shines with the love of God.
Oh, Baba always said that each one of you is divine.
Yeah.
Just that you do not know that you are divine. I know that I am divine.
This is the teaching of all the great teachers, isn't it? All the sages have said this, that realize the self. Awaken to who you truly are. You see, all the messengers that have come have come to awaken us to this truth within us. But we feel more comfortable putting them on a pedestal and bowing before them, because that's easier. That's easier than saying, I have to become the Buddha. I have to become the Christ. I have to become Ram and Krishna. You know, that all of this has to happen within me. That's not an easy journey, because it's transcending the selfishness of the ego. And so, even the Master Jesus, this was his mission. This was his mission, to awaken the Christ nature. We call him the Son of God. Why? Because he had totally realized his origin from the Father, Mother of the universe. But he is also opening our eyes to the fact that you and I are the sons and daughters of God.
Finally, he did say that I and my Father are one.
Exactly, exactly. People, you know, move on different levels, and the great saints would cater for all of these levels. So on one level, people will see the relationship to God as if God is there and I am here, a creature, creator, servant, master, and it's a beautiful relationship. We'd call it Dvaita in Hinduism, the relationship of
dualistic
philosophy. And bhakti happens there. But what happens is, as you enter into the relationship of father, son, master, servant, that sort of thing, is you find yourself drawing closer to God. At some point, you find that you're in the arms of God, and the distinction of master, servant falls away, and you become the friend of God or the lover of God. And now God isn't just there, but God is with you, in fact, very close to you.
Yes.
And I like to picture it that as you are in these arms of God, God gently presses you closer, 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 till you dissolve in God and you lose yourself in God. And that's what Advaita is this awakening to. All there is Brahman. All there is God at the end. It's really like the drop of water dissolving into the ocean. Again, I mean, I've quoted this so often. Paul's words, it is no more I who live, but Christ who lives in me. Jesus, the Father, and I are one. That is not a unique experience reserved for Jesus. It's an experience that we all have to have.
And the other thing also, which is common in all faiths, is we see verses, mantras or shlokas or chantings in some form or the other in every faith.
Yeah.
And you have seen Christian verses, and you have seen now the chantings of the Vedas. And the Gayatri Mantra.
Yeah.
So if you can share, what is your understanding of these verses and the Vedic hymns?
Yeah. You see, the ancient hymns of used in the temple, the ancient chants and so forth, have been used for thousands upon thousands of years. So when these verses are chanted, it is not just the individual chanting it, but they are connecting with thousands upon thousands upon thousands of years of worship. So that moment of the chanting of such a mantra, it transcends time. It takes us into a timeless space, because this mantra is so ancient, you see. And so the mantra itself receives its power from the devotion of the great saints that have chanted it over all that time. And so when I chant it, it's not just me chanting it that makes it powerful, but it's the fact that it's been uttered by the lips of great awakened masters, rishis and yogis and sages who have realized these things and uttered these syllables. These words are also very important, you know, because in Christianity we describe Christ in his pre-existent state with the God as the Word. We describe him as the Word. And in the Katha Upanishad it says, there's this word that is with Brahman. They that know this word shall be liberated. And what is this word? In Hinduism we describe it as the eternal sound of the Om. You know, we believe it is the first sound of vibration that happens at creation, from which everything comes out. And so the mantras are really an extension of that Om. They're an extension.
Yes. Every mantra in fact begins with Om.
Exactly, exactly. And so it's as if you kind of imagine there's the Om, the eternal sound, the eternal word with God, And out of that Om, that vibration, the whole universe is starting to expand. And the mantra, in a sense, is an expansion into that. And at some point, everything moves back into that Om. And you'll even find in the spiritual path, you know, people may start off with very elaborate mantras, and then soon they will get their one-line mantra from a guru at Guru Diksha or something. And when they receive that mantra diksha, when they receive that mantra, then they will start to use that one line. And at some point, they might just chant Om, and then at some point not even chant anything as they enter into the timeless silence that's in the heart of God, that God is leading us to. So, yeah, so these ancient mantras being chanted, just my personal experiences, I often in the evenings sit in the Ramana ashram where I'm living. Well, I'm not living in the ashram, but I go to the ashram, and I try to sit there around 5 o'clock when they chant in the Rudram, which is that ancient Vedic chant to Lord Shiva. And I find that as I meditate, the Rudram becomes like a boat that I'm sitting on. And this boat carries me on the river of God's love to the shore where I meet with the divine. And so I often see the mantras and the rituals as this boat that carries us into the God experience. And, you know, in the West, we get very caught up with this thing of understanding the words. And what that often does is it gets us too stuck in the head. I like the fact that sometimes you don't understand all the mantras. You know, in fact, they're too complex, some of the Sanskrit words, to even conceptualize it in the mind. And it's not about the words themselves and understanding them, but it's about this energy I was speaking that's contained in these words that have been sanctified generation after generation, that carries us to meet God. So that it's the vibration sound that's very important there.
I think that is a very powerful thing that you mentioned. I mean, to concentrate on the sound aspect. Because yes, meaning is good, but given that Sanskrit is such an ancient language and it is so complex, they say there are 9 rules of grammar in Sanskrit, so probably we'll never get to know the entire meaning. No one perhaps is able to give us this entire comprehensive significance of what these words mean, but I think they have been handed down to us over the years by very eminent scientists of the inner self.
Exactly. And how beautiful that India is one of the few, if not the only places, that has a language almost reserved just for worship, you know. It's mostly or mainly used just in worship. Really beautiful. But I also find the singing of devotional songs very moving, you know. There's certain hymns in the church when I hear, they really move me to this experience of Christ because of the devotion with which they were conceived and brought into words. And so the hymns become a carrier of this devotion. I love listening to Thiruvasagam, the words of Manikavasaga. You know, the Anglican priest Gio Pope translated the words of Manikavasaga, the great Tamil saint who wrote these wonderful praises to Lord Shiva. And they say when they found the original manuscripts on which Gio Pope wrote the verses, they were blotches on the page, because as he would translate it, he would just weep. He would just weep at the power of this worship to Lord Shiva, because he saw, I think, like I do, the father of Christ in Shiva as he read through those words. And Gio Pope said, you know, if the Thiruvasagam does not move the human heart to tears, nothing will. So, you know, there's the Vedic chantings that carry us, there's these devotional songs that carry us, these bhajans. And we should try to place ourselves in atmospheres where these things are heard as often as possible, because they cause a change within us psychologically, and it draws us into the inner space. And so for us who are on the path, whenever we hear these things are happening, be there. Just sit there. Even if you don't feel like going, I say to people, you know, go and just sit. And when you come out, you'll notice there's a shift in you. Even if you didn't understand what was happening, even if you was restless through the whole bhajan, just sit there as the mantras are being chanted, as the bhajans are being sung. And you'll find when you leave, something has shifted.
Yes.
This is the power, the vibration of those words carry.
In fact, there are so many stories of devotees who have come onto the Sai fold or come onto the spiritual path just after attending one bhajan session. They are so drawn to God, to that positive vibration, that bhajans, one session of Sai bhajans just transformed their outlook.
Yeah, certainly.
And I think that's why you see here in the ashram life, Vedic chanting and bhajans are an integral part of the daily ashram schedule, be it in the morning or evening.
I think most of the ashrams and temples would have that, and it really becomes sort of the foundation from which everything else happens, that there's this rhythm of worship. In the Christian monasteries, we have at least 5 times of prayer throughout the day where the psalms are sung. And if you ever stay in one of those monasteries, it's like again jumping into a boat, you know.
Yes.
That rhythm carries you, just carries you, and a deepening starts to happen. And so for me, the rituals, the chanting, the bhajans, all are part of this. But at the deepest level is the awakening of the heart of the bhakta. If these things are offered with bhakti, and if they are and you participate in them with bhakti, with absolute devotion and love for God, you will experience the full power of these rituals, this chanting, the singing of the sacred songs. If you enter them with bhakti, then you will experience this elevation taking place. You will experience yourself floating on the cloud of all of this into God consciousness. And so bhakti is important, but these things also will create bhakti in you, and they will increase bhakti in you.
I think these are certain things which aid us on that path.
Exactly.
So ultimately, the journey is an inward journey.
Exactly.
And the more you open yourself to that inward journey, I think the more higher you go and the more ultimately experience the bliss that is divine.
I think one of the saints who it was most evident in was that wonderful master Ramakrishna. You know, he had such intense bhakti for the Divine Mother, you know. He would be lost in love for the Divine Mother. And that bhakti would lead into very high states of jnana, to samadhi itself, where he will just be lost in oneness with the Divine as he experiences the inner self. And that's what bhakti, that's the goal of bhakti, to lead us to that place of just absolute absorption into God. And ritual, mantra, bhajan, all of these things are aids on that path of bhakti.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Father.
Thank you.
So that was Father Kumaran, Francis Subrayan. You heard his perspectives on the various Indian rituals, and as you clearly saw, there are so many ways these rituals have to be understood. There is so much of mystery in them. They have to be seen in the right perspective. Only then we can benefit from such potent power that these rituals have to spiritualize our lives. And I thought this is something that we should really reflect on, because if we have to divinize our lives, we have to take each of these beautiful things that have been given to us by our ancient sages and seers and see how we can use them for our benefit, for our spiritual growth, to help us on our journey towards God. And to just reflect on this and think about it louder, I've called Brother Sai Giridhar from the university. He's here with us now in the studios. Welcome, brother, to the studios.
Sai Ram Vishu.
So tell us, what are your reflections when you heard Father Kumaran?
First thing, I'm completely overwhelmed by the simplicity the depth and the wonderful way he presented his thoughts with clarity is simply superb. And in fact, the core message that I received from his talk is that Bali is a temple of God, which Swami has time and again emphasized to us. And we are all spiritual beings actually having a human experience.
Yes.
So in a sense, more than divinizing or spiritualizing our life, it's really to be in the rhythm of life itself. Because if we are we are spiritual beings having a human experience, and hence our natural rhythm itself is spiritual.
We have to become more aware of it.
Yeah, these rituals simply help us to align to our natural rhythm, which is so beautiful.
Yes.
And that is why we reflect the same in the temples, in the form of rituals. If it is a Shiva temple, we do all the Abhishekams. In fact, any temple, we do the Abhishekams right from the morning, as it was beautifully presented. Right from the morning, waking up ritual, to, you know, giving a bath ritual, to feeding him, giving him rest, giving him entertainment through music and all that. The whole experience is humanized, if I am to say, for a simple reason that it is a very strong pointer to us that yes, each and every one of us are spiritual beings having human experience. Which means every routine that we go through in our human life, if it's tuned in the right way, or if it's lived in the right perspective, we will simply be in tune with the rhythm of life itself, which is spiritual by nature. And one hardly needs to do much for that. But then when we tune and we get into the rhythm of life, then it's a whole new story. It's so beautiful. That is what I understand from what Father was saying.
So how do we really get into this special rhythm of life? I mean, you say this is the rhythm of life, but many times we are out of tune with this rhythm of life. So how is it that we can, from your perspective, get into this true rhythm of life?
Let me take any one such activity which we routinely do. For example, having bath.
Okay.
Swami says suchihi, or purity, is very important for any sadhaka, for anybody for that matter. And it involves both inner and outer purity. Though having the bath, the ritual of bath itself, is a very small aspect, an important aspect of external purity. But of course, it doesn't comprise of what really means external purity, which Swami has defined in a very, very beautiful and concrete way. We'll not go into that part. We'll just stick to the ritual of bath for now. I have had a series of wonderful experiences which had led me to understand how this particular everyday activity can be again brought in sync with the rhythm of life, or rhythm of nature, which is spiritual by nature. First experience was, I remember, I don't know if you remember, Vishu, we all had gone to Venkatagiri Palace.
Yes.
And we had a wonderful stay there for a couple of days.
Yes.
Listening to Swami's experiences.
And documenting Bhagwan's stay in that Raja's Palace, where Swami visited from 1950 to 1970 every year.
Yeah. And if you remember, we were taken to Swami's room.
Yes.
Which was so beautiful. And especially the bath area where Swami would have his daily bath.
Yes.
And we were told that the king would arrange for some 9 priests or something like that, who would sit outside Swami's room. And when Swami was having bath, they would chant the Sri Rudram.
Yes.
And it is literally like Lord Shiva giving Abhishekam to himself. It's a Rudra Abhishekam.
Yes. As Bhagwan is having his shower, they would chant Chamakam and Rudram.
Rudram. Namakam and Chamakam.
Yes.
That was the first most wonderful experience which hit me, in a sense, you know. I started wondering, oh, what does this signify? And it took many years of incubation after that, all the way up to last summer, when we all had gone on a pilgrimage to Badrinath, retracing Bhagwan's footsteps when Swami went in 1961 with his entourage. When we reached this place called Devprayag, of course, in our entourage, in Swami's entourage last year, we also had one Swamiji who had come, who is an ardent devotee of Bhagwan Baba. And we were all seated on the steps right at a place called Dev Prayag.
Okay.
Dev Prayag is basically a confluence of two major rivers, Bhagirathi coming from Gangotri and you have Alaknanda coming from Badrinath, already having merged with Mandakini from Kedarnath. And from this point onwards, from Dev Prayag onwards, the river gains the name Ganga, as we know her. So this very, very sacred point, it is said that Sri Rama had done penance at this point and all that. Swami himself had told all the people in his entourage in 1961 to go right down there and have baths, and saying that it is very, very sacred. So we all had assembled there for a sacred bath at the confluence of the two rivers, from where Mother is called as Ganga henceforth. And a very beautiful thing happened. Suddenly the Swamiji who accompanied us, he asked us to sit down on the platform right at the confluence. And he from somewhere got a bucket. And we were all chanting Rudram and Purusha Suktam and all that. Suddenly he said, okay, now chant Rudram. He filled the bucket with the water of the confluence of the rivers. And as we were chanting Rudram, he started pouring water on our head.
Okay.
And he did that 5 times for each person.
He did that on
he
each
did
person.
5 times for each person. Then he explained to us why he was doing that. Even as we were chanting that mantra, and as the water was, when my turn came, that is when I realized what is happening. And as the chanting was going, I myself was chanting, and water was being poured on my head. First I was, there was a conflict, in a sense, oh, this is done to a Shivalingam. And then quickly I recognized, Swami says, body is a temple of God. So that moment was one very strong moment in my life, when I realized that, yes, body is a temple of God. And maybe every day bath is an opportunity to do Abhishekam.
To do Abhishekam. Wow.
So Abhishekam need not happen only, it's so beautiful in the temples. But then there is a temple which we walk around in day in and day out, which is our
and
body.
The most fantastic creation of God.
Yeah, most fantastic temple.
Most
amazing temple. And there is another addition to this, that is, I remember way back in 1995, my Upanayanam happened here in Prashantanilayam. Swami had performed a mass Upanayanam for people from Hyderabad at that time, so I got a chance to be there. And after the Upanayanam, Swami was telling, if you don't have time to chant Gayatri 108 times, at least chant 54 times. If you don't have time to chant even those many times, Swami said, the simplest that you can do is, every time you have food, before that chant Gayatri. Or even while you are having food, you can mentally chant Gayatri, thinking it as an offering to Mother Gayatri, as you eat the food. And the other thing which Swami said was, when you are having bath, chant Gayatri, and that itself will become Abhishekam to Mother Gayatri. So these three incidents in my life.
These have come directly from Swami.
These have come directly from Swami. These three instances of, Swami telling about, our having bath and chanting Gayatri becomes an Abhishekam for, divinity within us. And then the Venkatagiri where Swami himself, in fact I heard that in Prashantanilayam also it used to happen. When Swami used to have his daily bath here in the Prashantanilayam Mandir, where Swami was staying in the mandir those days, the very renowned Vedic Pandit, Kamavadani Garu,
yes,
had this similar opportunity to sit outside Swami's room and chant Rudram when Swami was having bath.
Wow.
So all these experiences put together made an indelible mark in my own heart, and which has blossomed into a beautiful experience every day, which is,
yes,
giving Abhishekam to Bhagwan whenever I have bath every day.
Yes.
So twice a day, or at least once a day, you get a definite opportunity to give Abhishekam to Bhagwan through this ritual, yes, of bath.
Yes. I mean, that way the bath no more becomes a mechanical affair or a regular affair with no meaning.
Yes.
or it's not just, remove some dirt from your body
alone. Yes.
Alone. It is so profound. And I think that also
gives us the message and tells us how serious we should be about this. You know, it is not a very casual thing also. It is not just to go put some soap and, you know, come out of it. Wrap yourself, you know, clean yourself and come out of it. It is actually a very, very sacred activity for us.
Absolutely.
And if we take it that way, and I think, as you mentioned, then we will definitely be aware of the spiritual experience that we are already getting, but we're just not aware.
That, I think, is the rhythm of life. Means yes. This happens in every human being's life. Eating, sleeping, having bath.
Yes.
There is more meaning to it than what we see or how much we attribute it to.
Yeah. You talked about eating.
Yeah.
Why don't you share your perspective about food?
Food, of course, we have spent a lot of time talking about it in many sessions. But to be very brief about food, Swami once in Chennai, few of us were seated around Bhagwan, and there were few others who were not in that room because there was a limitation of space. So we were around 13 of us who were with Swami. Five of us used to sit with Swami and rest of them in a separate dining hall elsewhere. And there was one particular session when Swami suddenly looked at us and said, "Why are there only six people here, five or six people here?" And then Swami said, "I know you all don't want to eat with Swami." So we were all like, "No, Swami, this is the greatest opportunity that we can get." And Swami said, no, I know. Because when you eat down, away from Swami, you can eat how much ever you want. And then Swami also said, the second thing is, when you eat elsewhere, you keep talking and laughing and chit-chatting and all that, even as you eat. Swami said, in my presence, you will have to be silent while eating. In my presence, you will have to eat only how much is required. This is one experience. I'll narrate the other experience as well and bring the lesson that I learned from the two. Every session, the food would be served on all our plates. And of course, Swami's plate, Swami, there'll be lots of items from so many devotees kept there. But Swami would only take very little of whatever he would eat. You know, maybe little bit rice, little chutney. And, you know, he is still the very cute Swami from Andhra. So he will have just a little bit of rice and little chutney. I've seen Swami just mix the two and have.
Yes.
You know, he's so simple. And once the food is served on Bhagavan's plate, Swami would indicate and all of us would chant Brahmarpanam. That is the offering prayer to God. Once the food is offered, we would await to Swami. For Swami to take the first morsel.
Yes.
Moment Swami takes the first morsel, we would start eating as well. One day it so happened that we all chanted Brahmarpanam and we are looking at Swami and Swami did not eat. So Swami is looking at us and saying, "Oh, go on, eat, eat." So we were like gesturing to Swami saying, Swami should have first, then only we will eat. And Swami was insisting that you should eat, you should eat. So one of the elders took courage to make our gestures more vocal and said, "Swami, mundu Swami teskuvali tarvate mem teskuntam Swami." That is, first Swami should have, then only we all will have. Then Swami made a beautiful statement. Swami said, "Meerandaru Brahmarpanam chesar kada. You all chanted Brahmarpanam, offering to God, isn't it? When you offered it to God, all that food reached me. My stomach is full. How much more can I eat?"
Oh my God.
You know, from these two experiences, I learned that eating food again is not a dry mechanical activity. It is a great ritual. In fact, Swami elaborates elsewhere and says it can be converted into a yajna. And the fire in the yajna is the Vaishvanara which is there in our body. But the simple lesson here is when we chant Brahmarpanam with the feeling of love and offering to Bhagavan, it actually reaches him. He physically showed that. It actually reaches him. And the second thing is, how do we enjoy this ritual in the rhythm of life which we are talking about? That is what Swami said. If you want to enjoy this ritual as a spiritual experience which is natural to us, first we have to be silent while eating food. Second, we should eat only that which suits our physical condition. Every temple of God, this body, is different. The nature is very different. If you see Some temples, if you go to temples in the north, the way they are constructed is very, very different
yes.
from the elaborate constructions in the south, you see.
Yeah.
So the nature of temple is very different. It depends on the geography, the availability of resources, the way the natural surroundings are.
Local conditions, culture.
So many. In the same way, I feel the human body, which is also a temple of God, is like that.
Yes.
It differs from person to person, depends on various conditions in which
yes.
they are living in and all that. So, food that is suitable to us, our physical body, because this is a temple, we should not abuse it.
Mm.
We should not overeat, because overeating again is a sin, Swami says. Gluttony is a sin,
yes.
because you are abusing this temple of
yes.
God. So, these two aspects of first offering it to God, then eating in silence and eating only as much as we need and what is suitable to this body. I feel by just maintaining these three aspects while eating food can convert the experience of eating food into something very different. Just to give a more practical example to this, we all have heard of the Kirillian photography. By Professor Baranowski.
Frank Baranowski.
So there is this recorded incident where he was amidst students and Bhagwan when they were in a lunch session or something like that. And he had his Kirillian camera with him.
Which could record auras.
Which could record the auras. Mm. So he was wondering what would happen now. They're all seated to chant the prayer, Brahmarpanam now. What is going to happen now? After they chant. So he wanted to kind of record it through his Kirillian photography. So he took a picture of the food before Brahmarpanam was chanted. And after Brahmarpanam was chanted, he again took a picture of the food. He saw a very predominant blue aura around the food, which was amazing for him. So it is recorded that when he showed this to Bhagwan and asked, "What is this?" Swami said, that when you do these sacred chants, the whole food is divinized. And when you offer it, offer the food to God, the whole food is divinized. And this blue vibration which you see or color that you see is an indication of that. That blue represents the infinite beauty of God. Like Krishna, Rama, everybody
yes.
is represented blue because they are infinite, Swami says.
Yes.
In the same way, that infinity, that divinity expresses itself through food when you offer it. And in fact, Swami says, food is not an ordinary ritual. He says, Annam Brahma, Raso Vishnuhu, Bhokto Devo Maheshwaraha. The Trinity itself are associated with food. He says, the gross food is Brahma. The subtle food, the energy of the food, the vibrations, the liquids, the essence is Vishnu. Bhokto Devo Maheshwaraha. The one who enjoys the food is Maheshwara himself. So it is definitely not an ordinary day-to-day mundane affair. If one looks at this in this way, it becomes a very enjoyable experience, especially when you get in sync with the rhythm of life.
Wonderful.
Which is spiritual.
Wow. I mean... You're such regular things like having shower, like having food, and which we do like 3 times a day, 4 times a day, especially food. I mean, these things, you don't have to do any special prayers, right? These, every act that you do, the mundane acts will actually elevate you. You don't have to find separate time and sit down and pray.
Absolutely. In fact, Adi Shankara, in his... Shiva Manasa Puja tells one particular shloka which is so profound, really elaborating what you're saying. Adi Shankara says, Atmatvam Girijamatihi. He prays to Lord Shiva and says that my Atma is Lord Shiva himself. Girijamatihi, Parvati, who is Maya Devi or Shakti, is the mind. Sahachara Prana, that is all the Ganas who are there. They are the 10 sense organs and the Pranas. Who are serving the Atman and the mind. So, Sahachara Prana, Shariram Griham. He says, the body itself is a temple of God or the house of God,
yes.
of Lord Shiva. Kailasha itself is this body. Then he says, Vishayopa Bhoga Prasadaha. All that goes through these senses, the 5 senses of cognition, the Jnanendriyas. He says, all that goes through the senses, Vishayopa Bhoga. prasadaha are really prasada because it is offered to God and it is accepted in that manner. Whatever we see, whatever we hear, whatever we smell, whatever we touch. I think Father also was speaking about this aspect. How the various rituals, whether it is in the church or in the temple, ensure that all the senses are entertained in this way. Vishayopabhoga prasadaha. They are entertained in a divine way, in sync with the life or spirituality, when we do it as, do all the activities as an offering to God. So all that we see, we hear, everything becomes lovely and divine.
Wonderful.
Vishayopabhoga prasadaha. Sanchara padayo pradakshina vidhihi is his next statement in the sloka. That is, he says, my walking itself is pradakshina because you pervade the entire cosmos. Not only is God in me, God pervades everything. In fact, there is no me separate from God. We heard this from Bhagwan in the Shivaratri discourse.
Yes.
There is God, God and only God. So, sanchara padayo pradakshina vidhihi. He says, my walk itself is a pradakshina for you, O Lord. Nidra samadhi stitihi.
Wow.
When I go to sleep, there is a beautiful prayer which Swami has asked us to do. When I go to sleep, I simply merge back into thee.
Yes.
That is the state of samadhi. And then the final line is the summary of this whole session. He says, yadyat karomi tad akhilam shambho tavaradhanam. He says, yadyat karomi, whatever I do, 365 days, 24/7, yadyat karomi tad akhilam, every single aspect of it, right from breathing onwards, to all the activities that I do, shambho tavaradhanam, he says, O Lord Shiva, this is your worship.
Wow, fantastic. I'm speechless. Really, words fail to describe such a beautiful way Bhagwan has inspired Adi Shankara to give to us. And if every day we ruminate on this, I think there is no need to find time to do prayer. But in any case, Bhagwan, to make our lives easier, has given us so many prayers. It will, even if you cannot go at that level and, contemplate on yourself being the Atma and the senses being the Ganas, but at least you can think of the Lord at different points of time during the day. And Swami, I remember in a discourse many years ago, sometime in the 70s, he gave two beautiful prayers. He said, this is the prayer you should do when you get up in the morning, and this is what you should say to the Lord when you retire in the night. And I'll just share that with you. I think because that would be
wonderful.
Of immense benefit to all our listeners, and maybe we'll end with that.
Yes.
Swami says, on waking, pray this to the Lord every morning. O Lord, I am born now from the womb of sleep. I am determined to carry out all tasks this day as offering to Thee, with Thee ever present before my mind's eye. O Lord, make my words, thoughts and deeds sacred and pure. Let me not inflict pain on anyone. Let no one inflict pain on me. Direct me, guide me this day, O Lord. So this is the morning prayer.
Beautiful.
And Swami says, when you enter the portals of sleep at night, this is how you should offer your day's task at the Lord's lotus feet. He says, say to the Lord, O Lord, the tasks of this day, whose burden I placed on you this morning, are over. It was you who made me walk, talk, think, and act. I therefore place at thy feet all my words, thoughts, and deeds. My task is done. Receive me, Lord. I am coming back to you. And Swami says, adopt these as your daily prayers. This prayerful attitude will also educate your impulses, so that the inner intelligence in you will be fully revealed. And I think once the inner intelligence is revealed, as you mentioned, we will get into the rhythm of life.
Thank you so much, Brother Sai Giridhar, for coming from the university and sharing such beautiful insights. I know, I'm sure this will be of immense benefit to all our listeners and all of us who so much want to walk on the path laid on by Bhagwan for all of us. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Swami, and wish you for this wonderful opportunity.
So you heard two conversations, both focused on how to make the seemingly ordinary practices of our life into acts of extraordinary significance. They are of already extraordinary significance. We have to only be open to that. And once we are open to that, our life opens up. It opens up to new vistas of knowledge. It opens up to new opportunities of experiencing ourself. It opens up to new possibilities of experiencing bliss and joy every moment of our lives. And that is what is spirituality all about. Swami says the foremost duty of everyone is to be happy. There is a serious flaw in you if you are not happy. Swami says it is not an ordinary flaw, it's a major flaw. If we are not happy after having come to the spiritual path, because this is the royal way which will give us that calmness, which will give us that immense contentment, it will give us that sense of being like a rock. Doesn't matter what comes on my way. Once our foundation is solid, doesn't matter it is a cool breeze or a storm, we can weather any storm, because with us, the force with us is always more powerful than anything we will ever encounter. So let us make use of this opportunity that Bhagwan has given us. Every day is an opportunity, every second is another chance to take that one more step towards peace, towards goodness, towards truth, towards beauty, towards bliss. Let us spend these precious moments in sanctifying and sublimating the rest of our life and relish this journey, this beautiful journey that is life. With these thoughts, I will leave you on this Thursday. Thank you so much for being with us all the day through and listening to our series of programs right from morning after the morning bhajan session. We are so happy that we are able to do something in some way, share Bhagwan's love. There is joy always only in sharing. Happiness shared is happiness doubled. And for us, it is not doubled, but it is multiplied by a million times, because the more number of people listen and benefit, that is what gives a sense of, a great sense of satisfaction. And we thank Bhagwan for giving us this opportunity. And as always, we request you to send your feedback about any of the programs that you have heard. And in any way you would like us to modify, alter or better our programs, as always you can write to listener@radiosai.org. I am Team Radio Sai's Vishu, and in a couple of minutes from now you will be listening to a musical presentation, Yuga Yuga Ke Avatar. This was presented at the Sai Center at Pleasanton. in California during the Krishnastami celebrations in 2007. So that will start in just 2 minutes from now. It's time to bid you goodbye as we come to an end and draw the curtains for this Thursday life. Thank you so much for being with us. Let us offer our salutations at Bhagwan's lotus feet and pray that we ever remain grateful for what he has done for us, and let us determine to make the Lord proud. Let Swami say, "Here is someone I'm so proud." So dear listeners, here's wishing you a great day ahead, and finally a loving sairam from all of us at Prashantinilayam.